listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy. A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
All right, good evening. We are live here on the Weather Junkies. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from Connecticut. Tonight we have a special guest joining us from Oklahoma, Patrick Marsh, a meteorologist at the Storm Prediction Center. And of course, my counterpart, Dakota Smith, is live from Colorado. Dakota.
Good evening, everyone. Hope everyone's having a nice Wednesday evening. Tyler, I just want to get straight into the weather right now. You've had quite a busy few days, actually a few weeks in the Northeast. So what's the weather like now, and what did you have to deal with over the weekend?
Well, before we started the show, I was telling you how tired I was, and part of that has to do with changing schedules every couple days, but yeah, I would say in the last week we have been bombarded by winter, and it's not like we're getting a foot of snow every 3 days, but it is sustained cold, not impressive cold, but cold enough for snow, and just constant rounds of essentially nuisance snow, except for the first storm. It all started last Friday. We got a storm that really snuck up on us. I mean, it was within 36 hours. We had clouds, maybe some flurries in the forecast. Then it blew up into a plowable snow, and it still overperformed when all was said and done. Some places picked up 13 inches of snow in that storm last Friday. I believe I worked a 13-hour day. Then we had a nice quiet weekend, another storm on Monday that dropped a couple of inches of snow. We had, I can't even remember what today is, today's Wednesday. We had a few inches this morning, and we're expecting a coating to 2 inches tomorrow. So it's just been snow after snow after snow, again, mainly nickel and diming our way up the seasonal snowfall scale. But now, you know, after a little bit of snow tomorrow, our big focus is major cold this weekend with potentially record-breaking cold, which, as you know, is a struggle to get, especially in recent years. But we may actually have record cold here on Sunday, but it's only a weekend. It's not like last February where we had round after round of cold where it actually got annoying. It lasted so long. But that's where we stand now. Finally, winter has arrived. It was slow to arrive, and now it won't loosen its grip. So that's what we're dealing with here in the Northeast.
Well, you know, last week I had just come off of a 14-inch storm here in Fort Collins. Today it nearly got to 70 here, and so wow. It's safe to say I was wearing shorts and a T-shirt outside with, you know, a few inches of snow still on the ground. So yeah, that's what we've been experiencing here, and it looks like we're going to have a ridge for the weekend as you guys get hit with that pretty intense cold on the East Coast. Patrick is in Oklahoma as he works for the Storm Prediction Center. Patrick, what have you guys been experiencing in the past few days? I assume kind of similar to what we've had in Colorado.
Yeah, it's been very warm and dry. It's always fun in Oklahoma, and you know it's winter when you're driving home and you look off on the plane and you see multiple smoke plumes, and that's what we've had for the better part of the last week and a half or so. So winter's here, hot and dry, surprisingly. Yay.
yeah. So
can you send some of that snow down this way?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. Last winter, I kind of assumed Fort Collins was kind of a snow hole because when Boulder and Denver got all this snow, we would get significantly less of them. And this summer, we've overperformed. So I would gladly send some of the snow down there.
We'll take it.
All right. We'll learn more about Patrick here in a few minutes. But we want to go through a few tweets, right, Dakota, that we have selected this week. We have three tweets on tap that we'll discuss, and the first one was selected by Dakota, so you take it away.
Yeah, so I figured we start the show off with kind of on a light note. And this tweet comes from Ian Livingston, and the tweet says, things can always get stupider, period, always. And this is reference to a state representative in Pennsylvania wants an apology from the Weather Channel about comments made about the groundhog. And I thought it was kind of silly. Very silly. I'm reading some of the quotes here from the letter. They were offended by the on-air comments describing the groundhog as a rodent. I'm curious. I don't know if there's been a study or anything done on this, but I want to know how many people actually think, you know, the groundhog's shadow has something to do with what the weather's going to be like in spring or winter. Tyler, what do you think of the kind of the silliness that surrounds the Groundhog Day?
I think it's silly and ridiculous. That's what the groundhog is. It's a rodent. It's an animal that causes a stir in the media each year, as Fred Godomsky would probably say. I apologize. The phone is ringing in the background, and no one is here to answer it. But I don't have any problem with them calling Punxsutawney Phil exactly what he is. I think people need a little bit of reality sometimes, and sometimes the questions can be a bit excessive. What do you think about the prognostication from Phil? I don't really care. It means nothing.
Yeah, so do you actually get questions from the public on the Groundhog's Day?
Yeah, I would say so. Between that and squirrel tails and acorns in the fall, it can get to be a lot.
Yeah, well, hopefully that gets better as we, I don't know, prove ourselves as meteorologists. We prove ourselves as meteorologists and good forecasters. So let's get to the next tweet. Tyler, this is actually yours, so why don't you take that one off?
Yeah, this is a tweet from Tom Nizzle at the Weather Channel radar loop of a mega snow band producing rates of 2 to 3 inches per hour along the Lake Ontario shore. A remarkable amount of lake effect snow for this time of year. Dakota and I were kind of chatting about this before the show started, and we pulled up some ice charts to see where the Great Lakes currently stand. And it turns out that the Great Lakes overall, the current average ice cover is 5.9%, remarkably low. And if you look at the record of ice cover since 1973, which presumably is when the accurate record keeping began with the satellite era, the lowest on that chart is, let's see, 9.5%. In 2002, and I suspect that the ice has not been greater this year. I think that's probably one of the highest points it's been at 5.9%. So if we don't go up a good amount, this could end up being one of the least icy seasons on the Great Lakes, which is crazy. We just came off two of the highest years in the several decade record of the ice on the Great Lakes, and so even though we're halfway through February, we still have lake effect snowstorms.
Yeah, the image that he tweeted out was a pretty impressive lake effect snow band. I've always wanted to be in one of those, you know, massive, extreme 3 inch per hour snow bands. And it's very impressive that this time of the year that they're getting that snow production in upstate New York and parts of Pennsylvania.
And the third tweet was one selected by you, and it's going to spark quite a discussion.
Yeah, I think this goes well kind of into what our main topic is and with Patrick here. So this, if you know, you're a weather person, a weather junkie per se, and you've been following some of the things that has been on social media. This tweet comes from James Spann. It's tweeted at NBC Nightly News. And it says, you say no warning, I say they were excellent warnings, let's debate. And he's referring to, I think it was like a 5 second kind of thing they had up that said the storms, referring to one of the outbreak last week, the storm struck without warning. I think we see this often. We see something without warning often when there were warnings days, a week, in advance. And I one aspect of it, you know, I always thought, you know, a shame on them. There were warnings, they should acknowledge that. But I never thought about the aspect that not thinking it so technically. You know, warning without warning to some people might just be it was so intense or so dramatic. You know, their lives were changed forever. That's certainly without warning. They don't expect that. And Matt Lanza, who we had on last week, had a really nice article about that and brought up some of those points. Patrick, I'm sure you could talk about this forever, but do you have kind of a something off the bat that you think of when this happens?
I actually take the view that what James did raises the issue, but you have to be really, 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 really careful. If James has the gravitas to be able to pull something like this off, but if the weather community starts basically becoming internet mob justice type things, my fear is that we're going to start pushing the NBC Nightly News, the ABC News, whatever, away, and then they're like, well, why would I ever want to work with the weather community if all I'm ever going to get is grief about it? So there's this fine balance, and James certainly has the gravitas to be able to pull it off, and he can command a response like he did with Diane Sawyer last time. My understanding is the person who actually did the NBC News article was actually on James's podcast, Weather Brain Show, this week to discuss it. And so I tip my hat to him for being willing to step into the fire. But I think that we need to. I'm afraid that if the outrage can end up being counterproductive. It basically looks like we're a bunch of whiners. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some sort of fine line, and I certainly don't know what it is. I think we need to pick our battles, and that's something that I've had to learn over the last, I'd say, 1 to 2 years, especially on social media, is I have a reputation for poking the bear, and sometimes you've got a way. You should only poke the bear if there's something to be gained. So I think that the weather community, this is a valid concern. We do need to discuss it. We do need to come to grips with it. We need to reach out and work with our partners, especially those in the media, and we've got to be careful not to alienate them. And maybe in a little bit I can share some experience I had with a broadcast meteorologist here in Oklahoma, which kind of opened my eyes to how quote-unquote academics need to be careful with what they say.
I appreciate your take on this tweet, because it's probably not an opinion that you would hear frequently, especially online. Social media tends to turn into quite an argument, as you are well aware. But I Dakota, what you said about the without warning perhaps meaning something different, that's an interesting take that I hadn't thought of, but I would definitely say that as someone that works in media, we always have to strive for accuracy, and not just accuracy, but also responsibility. And, you know, if the person that wrote no warnings explanation was, well, you know, they didn't expect their life to change, that's without warning, okay, I kind of understand, but when you say without warning, I think most people think, oh, geez, there was no tornado warning, there was no severe thunderstorm warning, something like that. And I think that's why a lot of meteorologists get up in arms that it's a lie. And, you know, obviously we're very passionate about what we do, and it's not easy, and a lot of times we're wrong. And when we're right, it really burns when someone says, oh, you weren't right, because a lot of work went into the forecast and it turned out right. And it probably saved a lot of lives. So that's why I think this is such a hot topic, a touchy topic. But I really do value Patrick's opinion about the about, you know, being careful and knowing when to pick your battle. So it's definitely a conversation that needs to be had. And the other thing I will say is, you know, it seems to be that death, destruction, and, you know, perhaps wrongdoing sells. Other things don't sell. So there's this tendency for media to jump onto things and perhaps make it something that it's not. But a lot of things to consider, and it's definitely something that we're going to have to deal with as we move forward.
So yeah, this goes perfectly into, you know, why we have Patrick on the show. But before we kind of get deeper into this conversation, I wanted to have the viewers get a little better idea of what you do at the Storm Prediction Center. Your official title is Techniques Development Meteorologist, but you said earlier off air that you're a meteorologist at the SPC. So what is it that you do day to day?
Oh, well, that's a fun question. Ultimately, there is no day-to-day for me because I work in the Storm Prediction Center has two kind of branches, so to speak, to it. We have the operations branch, which are people who come in, and their primary job is forecasting. They're the ones who work the rotating shifts. They issue the forecasts, and we have multiple desks. We have mesoscale assistants, mesoscale forecasters, outlook forecasters, fire weather forecasters, and the lead forecaster. So those are all under the purview of the operations branch chief, which is part of the Storm Prediction Center. I work on the science support branch, which is basically we have multiple parts within the science support branch as well. We have IT, big data flow, make sure that the data comes in. I am what's known as a techniques development meteorologist. So I am a meteorologist, and on paper anyway, my job is supposed to be to develop new ways of visualizing data, new interrogation techniques for forecasters to be able to provide better guidance for them to help them do their jobs better. But in practice, it has evolved over the last few years where I'm doing less and less than that. And I've been doing more creating new graphics, modernizing our graphics, working on some of our communications to the public and the private sectors as well. And then occasionally, sometimes I'll work in, and I do fill in on the operations side, and I do work forecast shifts. I am very proud of the fact that I am not afraid to go in there and work a string of 7 midnight shifts in a row. In fact, I think the longest I worked in a set of 8 midnight shifts in a row before. I can roll up my sleeves and I can help out on the forecast side when we need to. I do it on the severe side. I also do fire weather forecasting when that's necessary. And so there is no day to day. My job can change pretty quick. I'm on call 24/7, so if something breaks in the middle of the night and it's my responsibility, I'll have to fix it then. I've been called during the day and said, "Hey, we've got a forecaster who's come down ill. Can you come in and work?" I've been called in on big outbreak days to help out. There was a time last summer where I worked a midnight shift. The person that was supposed to relieve me on the day shift called in sick, and so I ended up working a midnight shift. I worked the day shift. I then went home, took a nap, and came back in on my next scheduled midnight shift. So it's kind of chaotic. There is no day-to-day, but I'm dealing with weather, so the weather's chaotic, and the weather can change day-to-day, so it keeps you on your toes.
So it sounds like you're kind of a jack of all trades over there. But you said that you have a focus on new products and kind of I guess advancing some of the products that they have over there. And so that leads me to one of my questions that I had. And I think whenever I go to the SPC webpage, which is quite often, I always kind of think to myself, you know, this is a really nice webpage. It's really nice to look at. You guys always seem to be making new products, making products better. You know, to name a few things, the regional outlooks, where you can pick a state. I think that's really cool. You added enhanced, just I guess recently, relatively recently. And so I was curious what the process is like to add or change an SPC product. Considering that you're still part of the government and part of NOAA and the National Weather Service.
Yeah. So there's two parts here. If we want to add something to our website, for the most part, unless we're changing a quote unquote official product, we can handle all the necessary approvals in house. For example, we added the sounding climatology page last winter, and that was something that Jarrett Rogers, a forecaster, and I worked on, and we put together, and we showed it to our managers, and they said they signed off on it, and so we put it out there, and we were good to go. Now, things such as adding the marginal and enhanced to our outlooks, that goes through a very long process through the Weather Service, where it has to be, we have to come up with examples, we have to propose it, we have to send it up to headquarters. They have to sign off on it. Then we have to go through a product change notification process where we solicit comments and feedbacks, and we then have to make sure that those comments and the feedback that we get is not overwhelmingly negative, such as if AccuWeather or the Weather Channel or any other private company were to contact us saying, hey, when you're proposing going to this new data format, you broke all our stuff. We need more time to update our stuff. Mm-hmm. For example, another government agency, the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, we have to make sure that when we change a data format or something, we don't break their systems. So if we get notification that what we're going to do is going to cause undue burden, then we may have to delay it a little bit longer. The outlook change to adding marginal and enhanced took, I think it was discussed for almost a year, and then right before we were to go live with it, we got additional pushback, and so it was delayed from what we thought would go in effect in early in the year before the 2014 severe weather season. I don't think it went into effect until October of 2014. So things like that can come up. So there's a lot of things there is a big long process that we have to go through from time to time. But things like the state graphics that we added and the sounding climatology and the HER browser and things like that we can do in-house.
Our next question has to do with, as Dakota put it, the era of fleeting attention and the era of instantaneous feedback. And one of the things that we were wondering was, since these two eras came about, it almost seems like obstacles. Dakota says that he's seen a negative part of them far too often. Not sure if that's media sensationalism or unprofessional interactions with trolls on social media, but how does the SPC utilize fleeting attention and instantaneous feedback to improve the effectiveness of their communication? Basically, we see the positives and the negatives so quickly on Twitter and Facebook, and perhaps how does that impact what you do?
That's a very good question, and it's one that I can't say that I or SPC have the definitive answer. It's kind of we're kind of working through a process to try. Our goal is we want to be an authoritative, reliable source. We want to be the voice of reason, and so that's what kind of frames what we do. For example, when we put out the new one of the reasons why we created the state. And the state and FEMA and graphics was because we were hearing that you look on social media and people would be creating their own versions of our outlooks because they didn't like our computer graphics from the 1970s or whenever they came from, And so we said, okay, well, if we want to, make sure that the message is consistent from us through the pipeline, maybe if we were to create social media friendly graphics that people could just grab and drop into Twitter or Facebook and ship it out, maybe they'll start to come and utilize our graphics and things a little bit more, and we cut down some of this confusion, such as we have a very, very pronounced color curve where it's light green for thunderstorms, dark green for our marginal area, a yellow for slight, an orange for enhanced, red for moderate, and magenta for high. Well, it's one of those, if we could create graphics that were pleasing to the eye, so to speak, and real easy to just grab one and drop it into a Twitter post or a Facebook post, maybe then we can cut down on some of the people who would change up the colors some. Now, that's not to say that people can't come up with their own colors and can't use their own colors, but for me personally, when that happens, we open ourselves up for confusion. Why does the SBC has got me in an orange area? I remember that the SBC had me in an orange area. I can't remember what the risk actually means. Oh, look, so-and-so just tweeted a graphic, and orange is extremely dangerous risk. Well, that's not what the Storm Prediction Center was trying to convey. And so if we can try to keep all the colors consistent, that kind of helps with the communication aspect of it. And I've kind of rambled long enough that I actually have forgotten the original question. I kind of got up on my soapbox.
So do you guys ever, I feel like it's probably hard for the SBC to do something like this because, you know, you want to stay very, very technical and very to the point of the forecast. But how do you utilize, you know, having big attention grabbing titles or for instance, like, you know, the tornado emergency is a very attention grabbing and definitely pulls you in as a weather person or just as a, you know, someone in the public who's in that area.
The equivalent of a tornado emergency that we have is our particularly dangerous situation products for our watches. Traditionally, we issue on average maybe a handful of those a year. I think in 2015, we might have had one PDS tornado and one PDS severe, and that was it. And so the particularly dangerous situation is kind of our, we don't want to pull it out very often, and some we can go long stretches of time between using it, but when we do pull it out, this is our way of saying, hey, you need to be paying attention. And one of the things about the particularly dangerous situation watches, and this ties into our communication framework and the Storm Prediction Center communication plan, is everything, we try to be consistent in everything we do. And so, for example, if our categorical outlooks are driven by the underlying probabilities of various different hazards. On day one, it's tornado. We have probabilities for tornado, probabilities for wind, and probability for hail. And so you can take those probabilities, and we have a lookup table, and you can pull this, you can use this lookup table to find what those probabilities map into in terms of a category. And so we issue probabilities that justify a high risk. Anytime we have a high risk, the watches that are contained within a high risk are going to be particularly dangerous situation watches. And this is by design. We're trying to facilitate a consistency of message where if we're saying that your risk is high, then we want to also use our big end products, our PDS tornado and PDS severe watches to grab your attention as well. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to be in a high risk to issue a particularly dangerous situation watch, because anybody who's a fan of weather knows that you can have moderate risk days where you can have big tornadoes, and you know that they're going to be big tornadoes, but they may not be as widespread but they're going to be intense, and so you might go with a PDS watch in a moderate. And that's that's a forecaster discretion area. But if we do issue a PDS watch, then the probabilities that are contained in the watch, such as the probability of a significant tornado or the probability of the number of tornadoes, those probabilities are going to have to be sufficiently high within the watch to justify the particularly dangerous situation tag. That's kind of why when you have a high risk, the particularly dangerous situation tag is used, is because we want the watch probabilities to be consistent with the outlook probabilities. And if the outlook probabilities are high enough to justify a high risk, then that means we believe that our watch probabilities should be sufficiently high as well, and then that puts us into the particularly dangerous situation category.
We have a question from Twitter from a broadcast meteorologist, Ryan Vaughn, I believe it is, and his question is, what about color consistency between the Storm Prediction Center and the National Weather Service forecast offices?
I'm good friends with Ryan, and he is setting me up on this one.
That's the best kind of question.
Thanks, Ryan. Basically, when it comes down to between the Storm Prediction Center and the forecast offices, we cannot tell them what to do, and we don't want to be in the business of telling them what to do. We believe that this is a collaborative process. Some offices think that it's more collaborative than others, and we want them to have buy-in into our forecast and into our products, and we hope that they are willing to kind of be consistent. However, forecast offices have local customers, and they may have worked with local customers and develop something on their own, and they may go their own route, and we can't stop them from doing that. And maybe if that's the case, that they feel that locally they need to do something different, then maybe we should have a dialogue with them to find out what, if anything, we could do to help meet their needs. Maybe we need to reevaluate the whole. Like, for example, people, I'll deviate slightly from the colors, but let's say that people change and use different words than we use. We have the marginal, slight, enhanced, moderate, high terminology, and I will state right up front that this is a holdover from the past. I do not believe that SPC is completely wedded to this terminology, and we'd be open to having discussions about changing them. And if the local offices feel that they need to use different words, then maybe we should come together and talk about the words. Again, that would be a change to an official product, and so we would not be able to do that just willy-nilly. It would have to go through a product change notification, and it would take some time. But we'd certainly be open to it, because we do believe that the message needs to be consistent. If you go through the social science literature, you can find plenty of research out there that basically shows the more time a message is hammered home, the more likely it is to resonate with the person, and it's more likely to be ingested. And if we're using different terminology and we're using different colors, then we kind of put a disconnect there, and there's a potential source for confusion. And hopefully, as the Weather Service, we can work together to try to minimize the amount of confusion. But the fact is, there's one of us. There's 122 forecast offices, I believe, roughly around 115, 116 within the lower 48 states. So, from a consistency point of view, the color schemes from the forecast offices may not be consistent from forecast office to forecast office. And so if forecast office A is like, you should use these colors and you should use these words, and forecast office B says, well, we like these colors and these words, it's kind of hard for us to just say, okay, we're going to go with what another forecast office, or with forecast office A is saying. So I think when you see the differing colors, then we should probably work with on the consistency within the NWS
so
a little bit more.
So the consistency between the SBC and WFOs is something that you guys are working to improve. Are there any other kind of major issues, maybe the biggest hurdle that you think, not even just between the SBC and the National Weather Service, but between forecasters and communicators of severe weather outbreaks, either during the outbreak or beforehand or even after, I guess?
There are a couple things that come to mind. As you started that question, the first thing that came to my mind was the text contained within the Storm Prediction Center convective outlooks, for example. The Storm Prediction convective outlooks used to only be internal to the Weather Service. It was considered forecast guidance to the local forecast offices. So, excuse me. The Storm Prediction Center forecasters were creating products that were designed to be read by other meteorologists. And in particular, these forecasts had to be disseminated over teletype and low bandwidth systems. And in order to get those out quickly, they needed to be, the Storm Prediction Center forecasters started using standard abbreviations. There's actually I forget the official guide and the official acronyms and abbreviations that are to be used, but things like Western is abbreviated WRN, Eastern ERN. States go by their two-letter postal abbreviation, and so forecasters were typing that way. Well, you fast forward to 2016, and our products are now being viewed on the website, on our website, by thousands or hundreds of thousands of people every day. And we get quite a bit of email from people saying, I can't understand and I cannot read your outlook. What do all these abbreviations mean? And it's a valid concern. And so I think that the Storm Prediction Center can do better at cutting down on the abbreviations. Things like, we still get the, why are you yelling at me? Maybe we can eventually move to mixed case or something like that. But again, old habits die hard. So the example with the abbreviations, I'm not going to fault a forecaster who's been doing the same thing for 20 years if, when they're sitting there writing the product and they've got all this information in their head and is struggling to convey the meteorology in clear, concise language, if they fall into abbreviation mode. It's habit. It's natural. I mean, I think most of us would do that if we were in that situation. So that's one challenge of communicating in the 21st century. And I had another one, and I totally forgot it.
I think more often than not, we see great forecasts coming out of the Storm Prediction Center, but sometimes the feeling is that maybe that didn't get across to Joe and Sally on South Main Street. So what, a question that could go along with this is, who looks at the SBC page? What could we be doing to get this great forecast information to more people? Because I feel like sometimes it doesn't get to enough people.
That's a really good question. We're trying to reach out on Facebook. We've put our forecast out on Twitter. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, the Storm Prediction Center forecast is going to be digested by consumers and customers and the public at large more often than not through other avenues. They're not going to get it directly from us. And that this is one of the things that I think the Storm Prediction Center can and should do better, is working with broadcasters and emergency managers and our local forecast offices and private weather companies in making sure that they understand the nuances of what goes on and how we produce our forecasts. And basically, if we can build a better relationship there, then it's one of those, broadcasters are going to be the mouthpiece of the weather enterprise in more cases than not. And so if we can build the communication there, and we can help teach them what we're doing and what we're going through in our forecast process, then I think that gives the broadcaster a leg up in conveying that to the public. And I, from a personal standpoint, I'm not speaking on behalf of anyone else within the Weather Service or NOAA or the Storm Prediction Center or anything like that. But from a personal standpoint, I think that if broadcasters knew the name behind the product, there may be more inclination to trust the forecast, to go with the forecast, and so building that relationship and knowing that it's not just a name, it's another human being, someone who's spent years working on this, they're a great person. I think that plays into the communication aspect. And I think tying this into social media, I think that's one of the biggest disservices that the Weather Enterprise does with social media is we get on our soapbox, and I've been guilty of this myself. We get on the soapbox. We set up these automatic retweets where every single Weather Service product gets retweeted out to everyone. And that's good in pushing information out, but to me, the social media revolution is not about one-way communication. It's about two-way communication, and it's the building the relationships, and that's where the benefit is. And even though you may not reach all the people that you would, you've got to remember the trickle-down effect. And so if I reach one person, and then that one person goes on and reaches another person, and then let's say that I reach two people, and then each of those people go out and reach two people. And it's one of those, you're going to grow that message exponentially rather than linearly. And exponential growth is where it's going to be. And it's all because that you built this relationship with someone, and that person knows you and feels like they can come and talk to you. And I go back to the Ryan Vaughn question that he asked earlier, where he was setting me up. And Ryan and I became good friends because we established ourselves in mutual respect I hope it's mutual respect. I certainly respect Ryan on Twitter. And it actually came down to when I was working for the National Severe Storms Laboratory as part of Vortex 2, we had interacted some on Twitter, and he reached out to me and said, "Hey, my news director said that I can come out and do a story on Vortex 2. I can come be a part. Can you help me? Can you help set that up?" And I was like, "Sure." And so he came out, and we hooked him up with Vortex 2. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe he went out on May 10th, 2010, which was a big tornado day in central Oklahoma. And so it's that kind of interactions. You build that relationship, and now it's one of those. You don't want to abuse it, but if I were to bust the forecast, for example, Ryan knows that I'm human. He knows that who I am. He knows that I'm doing my best, and so he's going to be less likely to be hard on me, and he's more likely to come back and trust the next one because he knows who I am as a person and what I mean. That's the sort of thing that we need to use social media for, is building these relationships. I know that everyone's talking about, there was this big discussion a while back earlier this winter about, do we need to credential social meteorologists and all these other ideas so that people can know who's telling the truth and who's just a weather enthusiast and they're hyping things up. To me, I think the solution is, well, we need to do a much better job, the experts need to do a much better job of engaging people on social media and talking to them so that when the hype comes out, the people who see the hype come to you and say, "You're a trusted source. Is this what's actually going to happen?" Because I don't think we're ever going to stop the social media revolution, and we're not going to stop the hype forecasts. And
yeah,
I think it's one of those, if we can become the trusted source and we build that through relationships, through the broadcast, through individuals who reach out to you on social media, I think when you do that, you're going to have a much bigger impact than trying to say, "Hey, this is my specific forecast and everybody should be retweeting it, and only this one." Generally speaking, the forecast is going to be similar. There are going to be slight differences, but it's the underlying message that we need to work on. And yeah, I'm starting to ramble again, but I think the key is building relationships, and I think that's where we as a Weather Enterprise need to focus on our communication aspects.
Yeah, so I wanted to put Tyler on the spot here because he's a broadcast meteorologist, and I was curious, Tyler, how you utilize and communicate a severe weather forecast from the SPC. I know you don't get as much severe weather as some other places in the country in the Northeast, but what is the process for you, and how do you communicate that to the public?
Good question. I would say that my method of using the Storm Prediction Center has been molded in a large way by the chief meteorologist that I work for, and his saying is always that, look, there's no way we're going to out-forecast the Storm Prediction Center. We don't do this for a living, that is storm forecasting. These people put 8 or more hours in a day just focusing on the storms. They have the most knowledge and the most insight into what's going to happen. We are using their forecast. That is how I view the Storm Prediction Center. In terms of the outlooks, we use the same outlook, we use the same color, and we use the same terminology from the Storm Prediction Center. Again, we don't have a whole lot here in New England, but when we do, we pretty much are in lockstep with the Storm Prediction Center in terms of the forecast products. I suppose there can be a time when we may emphasize an event a little bit less or a little bit more, maybe in coordination with a local office if we maybe think we're being overlooked, you know, we're a small state. But generally speaking, we have a lot of respect for the Storm Prediction Center. Hurricane Center, same thing. We view these forecasts as forecasts that are produced by people that are putting all their effort into that very small niche part of the forecast. So that would be my answer. I think I agree completely with what Patrick is saying about relationships and being human. You know, we can't forget that, even though social media is kind of takes a lot of that out of it, and you know, people will say a heck of a lot more on social media than they'll tell you face to face.
Well,
I was just going to follow up and say that's exactly right, and it comes the good and the bad. Social media has a sense of anonymity to it, and so you will see things that people wouldn't necessarily say to your face. I've seen some pretty harsh things written about some of the Storm Prediction Center forecasters, and I'm like, if you knew that person and you knew, it's one of those that's the nicest guy you'll ever meet, and the things that you're saying are whew. But you've got to take the good and the bad. And I will say that I like to hear what Tyler was saying. From the Storm Prediction Center point of view, we don't mind if you guys tweak it a little bit. I mean, that's ultimately what it's supposed to be. You guys know your local area better, and we're trying to keep the big 10,000-foot view. And sometimes, like I know with the local forecast office in Norman, is if we draw our national outlook and we've drawn a category line that goes through the Oklahoma City metro, we split the metro in two. On their local graphics, they'll make sure that the Oklahoma City metro is in one single category, so that you can kind of cut down on the confusion, such as, hey, I'm in Western Oklahoma City, that means I'm in a slight risk. Well, I'm in Eastern Oklahoma City, I'm in an enhanced risk. Is my risk really that different, the 20 miles apart? I'm glad to hear. As far as I'm concerned, that's the way it's supposed to work. So I'm glad to hear that you guys use us as a start and tweak it in coordination with the local office as you guys see fit.
One thing I was thinking about when you earlier were talking about the criticism you guys get, I'm very glad that the work that I do now as a grad student isn't seen by the public, because man, I would get grilled for some of my coding issues and some of the displays, and it's crazy to think someone's job is completely just transparent to the public, and people are gonna rip you and support you, and I get ripped and supported by my advisor all the time, but that's not nearly as trolls on Twitter doing the same thing. I wanted to change the subject real quick. We had a question from one of our viewers, Ryan Breton. His question is, how receptive has the Storm Prediction Center / National Weather Service been to Dr. Marsh's innovative use of Python?
It's hit or miss. People really like Sharpie, and that's a big help in getting people interested in seeing the power of Python. For those of you who don't know what Sharpie is, the Storm Prediction Center has an in-house sounding analysis program. It's written in C. Well, I kind of converted all the routines into Python and opened it up, and so it's freely available, and you can do sounding interrogation using very similar tools to what we use at Storm Prediction Center. So that certainly helped. I didn't know this necessarily when I started learning Python, and I started kind of pushed the Weather Enterprise into using it. But AWIPS2, which is what's been disseminated, or it's the visualization and product generation software at all the field offices, it has a Python interface into the underlying data. And so a lot of applications are being written in Python to access the data to create plugins into the AWIPS2 environment. So that certainly has helped. The national centers haven't gotten there yet. But when the national centers, we still use GEMPACK and in AWIPS for a lot of our data visualization and things like that. So when somebody has to use GEMPACK, which is old Fortran code written by meteorologists or doing things the way that it was done in the 70s and 80s, and then I come along with Python and I can do the same calculations in orders of magnitude faster by using modernized techniques and approaches. That has helped. People are starting to see it and move that way. So I'd say that we're building. The Weather Service is certainly embracing it, albeit by my standards slowly. But I would guess by government standards at a fairly quick pace. But there's always room for improvement, and who knows? Maybe by the time the Weather Service embraces Python, we'll all be moving on to something else like Swift or whatever the next generation is. But
final question for this evening's show kind of jumps off of the last couple of minutes, and that is for someone that is looking to learn a new language or perhaps their first language from almost front to back, learn it thoroughly, let's say. You obviously are deep into Python. What would you say to those listening about Python, and perhaps how could they go about starting out to learn it? Any great websites you know of?
There's a lot of good websites out there, and a lot of tutorials. If you just do a Google search for Python tutorials, you'll get a bunch. I know Codecademy has yep. has Python tutorials. I know some people from the Storm Prediction Center have been working through those to learn Python. A lot of the modules there. If you go to the AMS annual meeting, there's typically a short course on Python. I know Unidata is working on, or is at least been discussing, do they need to start offering Python training and Python tutorials and things of that nature for the meteorological community. So that should be happening. I would be surprised if things like that aren't online within the next year or so. But probably the best thing to do to learn it is come up with a problem, something that you've always wanted to do, and then commit to doing it in Python. And don't be afraid to reach out and ask for help. Send me an email, send me a Facebook message, send me a tweet, and I will gladly help you get started and answer questions as you move through it. And there are a bunch of meteorology people out there that would do the same thing. And so that's probably the best way to do it is you can read a book, you can walk through a tutorial, but unless you actually try to do it yourself with no training wheels, it's actually not going to get ingrained. So I'm not knocking tutorials at all. It's one of those, I actually would walk through tutorials myself to try to figure things out. I'd get other people's code and I'd get it and I'd tinker with it and make changes here. And that's how I'd learned enough to then teach myself. So it's basically, ultimately, you're going to have to do all of this. But just do a Google search for Python tutorials, Codecademy, NumPy, SciPy. There's a bunch of things out there. And send me an email, send me a tweet. I'll post a lot of specific links your way as to things that you can do.
I love that advice because I came into grad school not knowing a lick of Python, and I learned it just doing my grad work, and it was easy. It was easy to learn, that's safe to say, compared to other languages I've learned. I can vouch. Learn Python. It's wonderful. It's great.
I was gonna say I was the same way. When I came into grad school, I did some computing programming in undergrad. I had Java and C and C++. I learned NCL, in-car command language, and I finally was like, I don't really like all of these because at the time I had a Windows machine and I couldn't use it. I couldn't compile and all that, so Python works on Windows. So I taught myself Python just by the first thing I ever did in Python was I wrote a script to calculate circles on a sphere so that I could generate range ring place files for the Gibson Ridge radar viewer.
Wow.
And I've gone back, I still have that code, and I go back and look at it and I scratch my head saying, wow, I'm surprised that even runs.
Yeah, I feel like all programmers have those moments when they look back at their old code. Wow, so from Groundhog's Day to Python, we really covered the gamut here. But that's going to do it for us tonight. We'd like to thank Dr. Patrick Marsh for joining us. It was a great conversation. Thanks for taking some time tonight to talk with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I look forward to it, and hopefully you guys will have me back sometime.
Oh, for sure. And if you're new to Weather Junkies, you can follow us on Twitter at The Weather Junkies, and we're on Facebook. You can listen to us on SoundCloud, YouTube, or iTunes. And if you have an Android and you like podcasts, we're also on Stitcher. Next week, we're actually changing our time. We're going to be same time, but on Thursdays now. We realized that our podcast is during another live weather podcast. That's the Carolina Weather Group. And our audience is probably a very similar audience, and it's kind of a niche audience. So we're going to change and be on Thursdays from now on. And we'll actually have Bernadette Woods from Climate Central on next week to talk about Paris and the climate summit that happened late in 2015. For Tyler and Patrick and myself, thanks for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next week.